Peter's admonition to us to live our lives in this world as sojourners and exiles. That's the English Standard Version rendering. Other translations translate or render these two Greek words as strangers and pilgrims. I want us to think for a few minutes this morning about what it means to be strangers and pilgrims. And the thrust of the lesson, really the main point of the lesson, is to keep in our minds always the understanding that we live in this world as citizens of the kingdom of heaven. That in a very practical way, in a very real way, this world is not our home. It seems to me as though one of Satan's most effective tools is not necessarily that he can entice us to engage in immoral activity or ungodly activity. And he really doesn't need to if he can just convince us to accommodate ourselves with the world. If he can just convince us to be comfortable in the world where we live, he wins an incredible victory over us. And so it's not surprising to find Peter emphasizing and stressing, as Nathan suggested, because we are a special people, a people for God's own possession, because we are a royal priesthood, we need to remember to live, or that we live, as strangers or sojourners and exiles in the world. What is the point that Peter's making? I'm not going to define those terms. Actually, I'm confident that we know what those terms mean, stranger and exile. Aliens sometimes is the word that the Holy Spirit uses. We understand and recognize what those words mean. Somebody who is a sojourner is somebody who's just passing through, not a resident. Somebody who's in exile is someone who has been a citizen of some nation or some country and is no longer a citizen of that country. A sojourner is a temporary resident. And that's a concept that Peter stresses and emphasizes a lot in this letter. He begins the letter by addressing it to the elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Here in our text, in chapter 1 and verse 17, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. And then in our text, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Peter's writing again to a group of people who are being persecuted. He doesn't write this letter to tell them it's almost over, it's going to get better. As a matter of fact, he's writing this letter almost, I think, to say to them, it's about to get considerably worse. He refers to it as a fiery trial. How do Christians deal with that knowledge, with that understanding? How do we deal with knowing that we face challenges in the world? Peter says one of the things we do is we remember that we are sojourners and exiles, that we are living as citizens of another world, but we're living in what C.S. Lewis called enemy-occupied territory. And I've always loved that imagery that Lewis painted. That comes from a collection of essays that were put together in a book called Mere Christianity. I know some of you are familiar with Mere Christianity, Lewis's book Mere Christianity. Mere Christianity is a collection of radio addresses that Lewis gave on the BBC. They requested that he do this, and it was during World War II. It was during the time when London was being bombed, and the days were dark, and so Lewis was invited, a number of others were as well, to come on and present these radio addresses. And those addresses were collected into this book called Mere Christianity. But I want to show you, and this is a longer quote than I normally would like to put on one screen, but I want to show you what Lewis says, which really stresses and emphasizes the idea that we are sojourners and exiles in the world. And remembering especially that Lewis is writing this during a time of war. So he used some of the imagery, some of the figures that he uses reflect that. But Lewis says this, one of the things that surprised me when I first read the New Testament seriously was that it talks so much about a dark power in the universe, a mighty evil spirit who was held to be the power behind death and disease and sin. The difference is that Christianity thinks this dark power was created by God and was good when he was created and went wrong. The universe is at war. But it, Christianity is talking about, does not think that this is a war between independent powers. It thinks it is a civil war, a rebellion, and that we are living in a part of the universe occupied by the rebel. Enemy occupied territory. That is what this world is. Christianity is the story of how the rightful king has landed, you might say in disguise, and is calling us all to take part in a great campaign of sabotage. When you go to church, you are really listening in to the secret wireless from our friends. That is why the enemy is so anxious to keep us from going. Enemy-occupied territory. This world is not our home. Satan is the prince of this world, the prince of the powers of the air. And the real danger, and again, I think the real challenge that we face as Christians is not necessarily that Satan will be successful in enticing us to commit some horrible, evil, immoral, ungodly act. That happens. We know and understand and recognize that we're all susceptible to that kind of temptation. Well, what really makes Satan so subtle and so evil and so dangerous is his effort to entice us to consider ourselves to be at home in the world. This concept of sojourning and exile is a biblical concept. It's a concept, I think, without coincidence. It's a concept that very intentionally runs throughout the Scriptures. There are a number of examples, Bible examples, of godly sojourners. Maybe the best example is Abraham. I'm not going to take the time this morning to retell that story. I will assume that most all of us are acquainted or familiar with the story of Abraham being called to leave his home and to go to a place that God would tell him. And Abraham packs up and he goes. He received that call more than once, as a matter of fact. But look at what Stephen says about it in Acts chapter 7. Look what Stephen, and you can see this in Genesis chapters 11 and 12 as well. But in Acts chapter 7, in this sermon that Stephen preaches before the Sanhedrin, he talks about Abraham. He begins by talking about Abraham being called, and he went to Haran, and from there he was called to go out from your land and from your kindred, and to go, this is verse 3, to go into the land that I will show you. Then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and lived in Haran, and after his father died, God removed him from there into this land in which you are now living. He gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot's length, but promised to give it to him as a possession and to his offspring after him, though he had no child. And then verse 6, and God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others, who would enslave them and afflict them for 400 years. Abraham was a sojourner. And Stephen says Abraham even understood that his heirs, his descendants, would be sojourners as well. Look at how the author of the book of Hebrews phrases that in Hebrews chapter 11, the Hall of Fame of Faith. In Hebrews chapter 11, I'm just going to read verses 13. Well, verse 10, he was looking forward. Why did Abraham do all of those things? Because he was looking forward to the city that had foundations, whose builder and designer is God. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. And so this idea of being strangers and exiles, it goes back at least to the time of Abraham. In the story of Jacob, Jacob is exiled from his family and spends a number of years in Haran and understands and recognizes that that is an exile. We've already noticed that the captivity in Egypt is referred to as God's people, Abraham's heirs, being sojourners or strangers in Egypt. And as a matter of fact, the psalmist in Psalm 137 refers to that very same kind of concept. He uses that very same kind of language to refer to what happened to the Israelites when they were in Babylonian captivity. The theme of sojourner, exile, stranger is a theme that runs consistently throughout the Old and the New Testament. As a matter of fact, some 20 times, and I don't have an exact number, but some 20 times in the New Testament, God's people are referred to as strangers. I mentioned accommodation a few moments ago. I want to think about that for just a second, because I think this is the real challenge that most of us face as Christians. Again, all of us are confronted with temptations to commit sins. All of us are susceptible to different kinds of temptations, moral things, ungodly things. All of us are placed in those kinds of situations. But the fact that we're here this morning, and the fact that we're not the only group in this town who's assembled together like this morning, the fact that there are Christians who are assembled together on the first day all over the world to remember the death of Christ on the cross, the sacrifice that he made for us, indicates to some degree at least that Satan is not as successful, clearly not as successful as he would like to be, in challenging us to abandon our relationship with God by engaging in ungodly, immoral, sinful activities. Again, all of us are challenged with that. All of us face those kinds of temptations. And perhaps from time to time, all of us step across some line like that. I think the real success of Satan, though, is not so much that he is able to entice us away from God with the immoral and ungodly things that are associated with the world, but he does tempt us to accommodate ourselves with the world. What do we mean by accommodation? The word accommodation is defined as being made fit or suitable to acclimate or to adjust, to reconcile opposing views, or to compromise. I think that's the real challenge that we face as Christians, is that Satan is tempting us to accommodate ourselves to the world. I know this is so. I know personally that this is so. I know from experience that this is so, that we get comfortable in the world. And we get comfortable with things that are going on around us in the world that are ungodly things, the things that we know, if we were more careful, we know are the kinds of things that would not be approved, that would not be acceptable by God. We get to the point where we stop being provoked by what we see. A couple of examples of that in the New Testament, of people who were provoked by what they saw. Look at Acts chapter 17. We'll do that one first. Acts chapter 17, Paul is in the city of Thessalonica, and then he has to leave Thessalonica, and he ends up in Berea, and he finally ends up in the city of Athens by himself. It's really the only time in the New Testament story of Paul that we find him in a place completely by himself with no companions at all. Athens, the city of Athens, was one of the natural and man-made wonders of the ancient world. And some of the things that are associated with ancient history are associated with the city of Athens. I would love to see the city of Athens now. It's on my bucket list of things that I don't know that will ever get accomplished, but I'd love to go to Greece. I'd love to see some of those places. And Athens at the very top of the list. What I'm suggesting to you is that Athens had that kind of allure in the first century. It was an ancient city when Paul went there. It was an historic city when Paul went there. And beautiful, incredible things to see. Look what verse 16 of Acts chapter 17 tells us, though. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. Paul doesn't look at the city of Athens through the eyes of a tourist. He looks at the city of Athens through the eyes of God. And what he sees does not impress him. It provokes him. It stirs him up. The same thing happened to a godly man in the Old Testament, but the story or the point is made in the New Testament in 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2, by the way, contains one of the most blistering and powerful and strong rebukes of false teaching that you find any place in the New Testament. Peter just unleashes with both barrels on the false teachers. He doesn't pull any punches. But in the midst of that, he reminds us about Lot. He talks in verse 6 about God having turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes. And then he says in verse 7, he rescued righteous Lot. Well, why did he rescue righteous Lot? Because Lot was greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked. For as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Lot lived in a city that historians tell us would have been large and impressive, probably somewhere around in modern times, somewhere around the southern shore of the Dead Sea. A large city, a prosperous city, a thriving city. He didn't look at, according to Peter, by inspiration, and we understand that Lot made some bad choices. Lot made some bad decisions. But he didn't look at the city where he was living through the eyes of a proud resident. He looked at the city through the eyes of God. And Peter says it distressed him every day. It scares me sometimes to read passages like that. That Paul goes into this incredible city, historic city, beautiful city. And what impresses him and provokes him is that the city was full of idols. Lot is living in a city that scholars tell us would have been large and prosperous, a beautiful city. He doesn't look at that city through the eyes of regional or occupational pride. I am a citizen of Sodom. He looks at that city through the eyes of God, and he is provoked and distressed every day, Peter says, when he sees and hears the things that are going on around him. What about me? What about us as Christians? You know, we have incredible opportunities, even just in this country. We have incredible opportunities to visit some unbelievable places. Susan and I took a trip this past summer that I've always wanted to take. We went to Boston. And we walked to the Freedom Trail, and we went to Lexington, and we went to Concord, and we went to Quincy, and, you know, where the Adams lived. And it was just an incredible trip. And, when I think about that trip, when I think about going to play, you think about some of the magnificent things there are in this country, some of these places, like Athens would have been in Greece in the first century, or like Sodom would have been sometime in Old Testament times. When we look at places like that, do we look at them strictly and purely with tourist eyes? When we go to places like that, are we ever provoked by the ungodliness that we see? Or do we ever even stop to think about that? You know, where we live, you know, are we so filled with regional and sectional pride that when we look at the place where we live, you know, what we look at it through those eyes, and we don't look at and we're not provoked by the ungodliness that is so prominent around us? I've told this story before. We got to go to Seattle a few years ago, the Emerald City, beautiful, beautiful place. We were staying in a motel out by the airport. We took the train into downtown Seattle. We got off at one of the stops and we came up through the tunnel and we walked out onto the streets of Seattle. This is my first view of the streets of Seattle. The very first Seattleite, would that be correct? I don't know. The very first citizen of Seattle that we meet, he walks up to me and he offers his hand and he shakes my hand and he's holding a sign that says, "Need money for marijuana." My introduction to the city of Seattle. You know, there's some incredible things to see. But what scares me, I won't put this off on you. I'll let you make your own application. What scares me is that Satan is being a lot more successful in my life than I'm comfortable admitting. And that I can get right comfortable in this world. I can be very comfortable and happy and content in South Central Kentucky. I can be very excited in going to big cities like New York and Boston and Seattle and Chicago and Louisville and Nashville, and my eyes get really big and I see all the lights and I see all the stars and I see all the great places to eat, and I just, you know, this is just, wow, how exciting is this? How neat is this? And all around me, every place I go, all around me are people who are practicing, openly practicing all kinds of ungodliness and immorality, and I don't even see that. I don't even notice that. I don't pay any attention to that. I know I've told this story before. I'll tell it again because I'll forget that I told it. But many years ago, I would sit and watch television with my grandfather. About the only television that my grandfather would ever watch was when a baseball game was on. I'd hate to admit this about my grandfather, but he was a Cubs fan. All of us have things in our family past that embarrass us, but he was a Cubs fan, and we would sit and watch the Cubs games. And we were watching a Cubs game. I forced myself to watch Cubs games with my grandfather, and watching a Cubs game, and they had a guest announcer on, and his language got a little salty, like language will do. My grandfather turned the television off. My grandfather turned the television off. I wondered why. It didn't have anything to do with the game. Found out later on that he didn't want to have to sit and listen to that kind of language. Let me ask you a question. When was the last time when you were watching a television program or a movie when bad language was used that it provoked you? That it distressed you? To the point that you got up and walked out of a theater because of the language? Or the attire of the people who were on the screen? Or turn the television off, or at least change the channel on a program. Accommodation. Accommodation. We can't ever get to the point where we are not provoked by what we see and hear in the world, because we are strangers and pilgrims. How do we get there? Three things. We've got to make sure that we have the proper attitude. Look at Colossians chapter 3. Verses 1 and 2. We've got to make sure that we have the proper attitude. In Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1 beginning, Paul says, "If then you have been raised with Christ." That's us, isn't it? That's us. We're Christians. "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated, at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things that are above, not on the things that are on the earth." What is important to us? You know, what is important to us? What is it that when you've got a moment of quietness, when you've got a moment of calm, when you've got a moment of peace, and you can think about whatever you want to think about, your attention is not being occupied by anything else. What is it that you think about? What is it that you worry about? What is it that you're concerned about? What is it that excites you? What is it that bothers you? Paul says, because we have been raised up with Christ, those things ought to be what he calls the things that are above. The thing, what's really important to us? What's really important to us? The things that are above and not the things that are on the earth. Why is that? Because, number two, above is where our treasure is if we are Christians. That's the point that Jesus makes in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 19. "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, but where thieves do break, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." We're looking at things above because that's where our treasure is. Let me tell you something, brethren. If we are constantly this, if you'll allow me a little bit of exaggeration to make this point, if we are constantly thinking about things that are going on around us in the world, and I'm not talking again about necessarily horrible things or bad things or evil things, just world things. If that's what we think about, when we've got that quiet moment, if what pops into our mind is sports or politics, or you fill in the blank with whatever else, then where is our treasure? Where is our treasure? And can we really say that our treasure is in heaven, that our treasure has been laid up above? I think one of the tools, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, I think one of the tools that Satan very clearly uses to get us to accommodate with the world is he tries to make sure that we spend as much time as possible with people of the world. And so, in passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. You know, what is bad company? I think that we are tempted to define bad company as those really horribly immoral, ungodly, bad people. Well, that would certainly qualify as bad company. But that can't be all that is involved in bad company. Bad company is someone who doesn't share my goals, someone who doesn't share my faith, someone who doesn't share my views. Maybe not a radically evil or wicked person, but just a person whose faith, whose life is focused primarily on the world. Don't be deceived. The wrong kind of company corrupts good morals. We need to be careful about who we spend time with, who we spend the most time with. That's not at all, by the way, to say that we spend no time with people who are in the world. We live in the world. We are among the world. We live there. We're not of the world, but we are among the world. And we have the responsibility of trying to teach people who are in the world. That's not the point that Paul's making. The point he's making here is it's very easy to accommodate ourselves to the world, to accommodate ourselves to how they dress, to accommodate ourselves to how they talk, to accommodate ourselves to the kinds of things that they think are important if we spend a lot of time or the majority of our time with those people. We need to be remembering that we're trying to get home to heaven. That's what it means to be a stranger and a pilgrim. And in order to do that, we've got to have the heart of a pilgrim. There's an interesting passage in Exodus chapter 23. And in this text, God, through Moses, is teaching the Israelites that you need to treat strangers well. You need to be kind to strangers. Well, why? Because, he says, you were a stranger at one time. You shall not oppress a sojourner. You know the heart of a sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You know what it means to be a sojourner, to be a stranger. And so you treat sojourners in a good way. You treat them in a right way. We need to have the heart of a sojourner. How do we do that? How do we get that? And how do we keep it once we get it? Well, we need to be reading and studying about heaven. We need to be reading and studying about heaven. I suggested in a lesson a week or two ago that it concerns me that so many Christians spend more time reading things about the Bible than they spend time reading the Bible. I think we read newspapers, or we read actually, probably we don't hold, not very many of us hold newspapers in our hands anymore. We access that news on our screens, and we read about what's going on in the city where we live, and what's going on in the state where we live, and what's going on in the nation where we live, and what's going on in the world where we live. And we saturate our minds, and again, not necessarily evil things, not necessarily immoral things or ungodly things, just world things. And those are the kinds of things that occupy us, and we spend very little time thinking about heaven. Very little time thinking about heaven. Heaven is home. If I really believe that heaven is home, I want to know as much as I can about it. All I know about it now, I believe and accept based on faith. The evidence of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1. I believe it's there. I believe it's a place beyond my ability to appreciate. I have to read about it and accept it and study about it. I want to know everything that I can know about home. I want to meditate about heaven. How do I get there? What do I have to do to get there? How do I have to live so that I can get there? Let me tell you something. I want to be talking, if I really have the heart of a stranger, I'm going to be talking to people about heaven. I'm going to be talking to people about heaven. It's interesting to me. I don't mean this as much of a criticism as it's probably going to sound. But it is, I think, of some more than passing interest that as soon as we say amen in a few minutes, we will stand up and we will start talking loudly about everything in the world that you can possibly imagine. There'll be a group someplace talking about sports. And there'll be a group someplace in this room talking about politics. And there'll be a group someplace here talking about road conditions for, you know, trips that we're going to be. Is there anything wrong with talking about those kinds of? No, not at all. You know, but would you not think that there would be some interest among some of us at least in talking about heaven and talking about spiritual things? When you get together with your Christian friends, I mentioned a moment ago that we need to be careful about spending too much time with people whose view is a world view and not a God view. But even when we get together with our friends who share our view of God, what is it that we talk about? I mean, I'm just asking. What is it you're excited about? I've told you all before, I'm very glad that the Bible does not say you are what you eat. I'm thankful for that. But the Bible absolutely does say we are what we think. We are what we think. How do you know what's in a heart? What's in the person's heart? How do you know what's in a person's heart? What comes out of their mouth tells you what's on their heart. So if all we ever talk about is sports, or all we ever talk about is food, or all we ever talk about is the weather, or all we ever talk about is politics, what that's saying to the world, whether we accept that or not, whether we appreciate that or not, what that's saying is that those are the things that are really the most important to me. If people never hear us, if our families never hear us talking about heaven, if our co-workers never hear us talking about heaven, if our neighbors never hear us talking about heaven, if our friends never hear us talking about heaven, God forbid, if our brethren never hear us talking about heaven, what does that say about where our hearts are? Thankfully, we do this, I think. We sing about heaven. We sing about heaven. You get the picture. I hope you get the picture that I'm trying to paint there. Is heaven, if we have the heart of an exile, the heart of a sojourner, the heart of a stranger, then we need to focus our attention more and more and more on heaven. Sojourners and exiles. Have you ever heard this? Home is where the heart is. Surely you have. It's an adage that is fairly popular. Where, as we extend the invitation this morning, I ask the question, where is your heart? Where is your heart? What Peter is telling us is this. The Christian's home is in heaven. The Christian's heart is in heaven. That's where God is. That's where our Heavenly Father is. And we're trying very hard to get there. I think Satan is not going to be in terms of percentage, in terms of numbers, Satan is not going to be all that successful keeping people away from heaven by getting them to engage in grossly immoral and ungodly acts, in grossly immoral and ungodly conduct. Again, everyone is susceptible to that kind of thing, and it happens. I suspect, though, I fear that Satan will be a lot more successful by number in keeping Christians from getting to heaven by just making us comfortable in this world. By making us comfortable in this world. This world is not my home. Albert Brumley wrote, "I'm just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door." Let me ask you something, brethren. Could you sing the next line right now? Only you can answer this question. Could you sing the next line of that song right now completely free of hypocrisy? I heard Bill Hall say one time that perhaps no single act produces more hypocrisy in Christians than singing the words of the psalms and hymns and spiritual songs that we sing when we assemble together to worship. Could you, without hypocrisy, sing the next line to that song? "And I can't feel at home in this world anymore." You know, God help us all to have the heart of a sojourner, to not be guilty of accommodating ourselves to this world, but try to the best of our ability to live in such a way that we can survive this world and make it home to heaven. If you're here and you're not a Christian, then the invitation for you is to begin that journey home. Renounce your citizenship in the world, become a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, and then begin the process, begin the journey of going home. Can we help you to do that? The Bible says that people did that by confessing that they believed Jesus was God's Son and repenting of their sins and being baptized for the remission of sins. In those actions, they renounced the citizenship of the world. They turned their backs on citizenship in the world. We still live in the world, but we're not citizens of the world. That's not what's important to us. We are citizens of the kingdom of heaven. Most of us in the audience who are old enough to be accountable to God have already done that at some time in the past. And so I'll ask again, do you feel at home in this world? Would you have to sing to keep from being guilty of hypocrisy? Would you have to sing, "I feel right comfortable in this world. I'm pretty happy in this world. I'm pretty content in this world. Heaven is okay, but I'm not ready to go now. I'd like to spend as much more time in this world as I can." Is that what we'd have to sing? Or can we sing, "I can't feel at home in this world anymore"? If you're subject to the invitation, perhaps just a need to admit to God that you have accommodated yourself to the world and ask God's and maybe your brethren's assistance or help in getting your priorities back in a right place again. Can we help you in any way to do that? We're going to sing this song, which is number 300 in the Maroon Songbooks. If you're using the songbook, "I Am Coming, Lord," we would love, it would thrill us to see someone coming with those words on their lips this very morning, "I am coming, Lord," to respond to the invitation. If we can help you in any way, please let us know how by coming right now while we stand and sing. We invite you to come.